Thank you very much for coming to this session. It is very happy to see that wonderful work has been done in this area so that we can learn from each other. There are a lot of work to be done. So it is well known that there are disparities in mental health treatment, and in earlier Surgeon General's report, there is disproportional burden of mental illnesses and being shouldered by the minorities, Blacks, Latinos, American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. So one of the reasons that caused these disparities could be culture. And culture is huge. And which aspect of culture are we talking about? And from the anthropologists, they claim that people from each culture have their own explanatory model of illness. With the same illness, people from different backgrounds, they may perceive it, they may look at it, or react to it very differently. In many non-European cultures, there are no equivalent concepts of depressive disorders. So that may explain why a lot of the previous presenters saying that Asians, they do not come forth to seek help when they have depression. And if we compare the East and the West broadly, we notice that in the West, people have adopted the idea of dichotomy, mind and body, they are separate. It is considered separate. Today, if you go to Asia, they do not consider mind and body separate. They are still using a holistic approach. And because of this approach, they look at what we now call mental illnesses differently. This is why anthropologist Arthur Kleinman, when he went to China and studied patients with depression, he noticed that a lot of them do not talk about sadness. No, they do not talk about sadness. They talk about what we call somatic symptoms, headaches and shoulder pain and so on. And if this is the case, it would be much harder for clinicians to diagnose patients, Asian patients with depression if they do not talk about their sadness. Particularly if those patients, they go to primary care clinics, and a lot of them do not come to seek help to the mental health providers. They go to primary care clinics and they tell their primary care doctor about their physical symptoms. And of course, the primary care physicians will first check their blood pressure and listen to heart and so on, and not to first consider about depression. That may lead to a lower recognition rate of depression. And we summarize some of the cultural barriers for Asian Americans in accessing mental health services, including a lot of them, they are not familiar with the definitions of psychiatric disorders. Remember that psychiatric disorders, we are talking about DSM, we are talking about ICD, they originated from the Western culture. They use the terminology, the concept in the Western civilization. And to a lot of the Asians, these are fairly unfamiliar. And of course, just earlier we mentioned that about 60% of Asians here, they are immigrants, and there are language barriers. Imagine you have to use a foreign language to seek help and to do psychotherapy. It is fairly hard. We can use interpreters, but the effect is usually not as good than using native language. And then even if you translate the term like depression into Japanese, Korean, and Chinese, it is not their lexicon. And when I see patients in Boston, Boston immigrants, when I tell them you have depression, 20% will say that never heard of it. So what do you do? And also, because of the origin of their society, people from Asia, there are very few psychiatrists compared to the Western countries in Asia. Psychiatrists in Asian countries, they take care of the sickest there. So people who immigrate from Asian societies, they rather not to be associated with psychiatrists. And in China today, if you go there today, they are still having the Soviet form of asylum, a hospital with 700 beds, 1,000 beds, with people who stay there for 6 years, 7 years, 10 years, and this is the norm. And who takes care of depression in China? Neurologists, or acupuncturists, or internists. people do not go to seek help from psychiatrists. They take care of crazy people. This is the concept in China. And earlier, we studied 29 small group of Chinese Americans in Boston, Chinatown. We used screening instrument to identify those people with high amounts of depressive symptoms. We interviewed them with standardized instrument and then confirmed that they had major depression, DSM-3 at that time, DSM-3R. And then we asked them, so what bothers you the most? What we call chief complaint. And then people report mostly physical symptoms. Some reported like sleep or appetite. And none of them consider depressed mood as their most important symptom. But I have to emphasize that if you ask them, look at their back depression inventory that they first checked out, more than 90% check, yeah, I'm sad. But if you sit down with them, so what bothers you the most? None of them consider depression. They will say, I'm here because I have a headache. I'm here because I have a dizziness and so on. Sadness, depressed mood doesn't come to mind. Not that they do not know. There were early literature saying that maybe they don't even know that they are sad. They do, and they report it. On the other hand, they do not consider that something to talk to the physicians or clinicians. And what do you call it? So we repeated the DSM symptoms to the patient, and so you reported these symptoms. What do you call it? And most patients said, I don't know. I have been having poor health for many years. I don't know what I call it. And what kind of help have you sought for the symptoms you have reported? And mostly have sought help from primary care physicians, primary care clinics. And very, very few of them ever try to seek help from mental health providers or professionals. So this is a big concern. We know from the literature that in primary care, the rate of recognition of depression tend to be low or lower. And also the rate of treatment, effective treatment, tend to be lower. This is why ACA has been trying to handle this problem with collaborative care, trying to merge the expertise between primary care clinicians and mental health providers. And so we try to summarize, we are faced with four problems. One is that both the patients and the clinician tend to under-recognize depression among Asians. And then even if you tell them they have depression, they may not want to seek help because of stigma, because they do not know what mental health providers can offer. Like a patient or patients frequently ask me, so just talking can help me? So this is the concept, just talking to my friends, why should I come here? So, and then, and also there is a low level of literacy on a lot of mental illnesses and high stigma, as I mentioned about the traditional providers or traditional mental health providers in Asian societies. So they try not to be associated with them. And even if we started them on medication, on treatment, and a lot of them do not come back, my patient said, I don't want to come here, people see me sitting here waiting for you. So you can imagine how happy my parents were when I said, I want to go into psychiatry. So we designed this method of trying to address this underutilization and the treatment issue. We use culturally sensitive collaborative treatment, and also we added telepsychiatry technology. What we did was we tried to address the earlier four challenges by systematic screening of depression in primary care clinics. This has been talked about for many years. Most clinics have not been doing this for logistic reasons, for cost considerations, so on. So we have implemented that for more than 10 years in Boston. People who come to the primary care clinic only in their annual physical, it is not possible to do it every visit. Only annual physical, we ask them about to do the screening. And people who screen positive, we collect all the forms and all the PHQ-9s, and then we call them up. So instead of waiting for them to come to see us, they will not come to see us. So we call them, Mr. A, you reported so many symptoms, you must be bothered. Would you mind coming in to see us? And about half of them say, no, thank you. I'm not crazy. And half of them did come in, and then we'll show you the results. And then we designed a way to provide culturally sensitive interview to our patients. So in the next 10 minutes, I'll tell you how to provide culturally sensitive interview. And then we also use care management to improve adherence. So this is PHQ-9, which is similar to the DSM-4-5 in diagnosing depression. We translated it into Chinese and validated this instrument. And then people who screen positive, we call them and ask them to come in. And then we interview them with, this is a standard form of psychiatric interview form. And then we add to this form three items, what we call the illness narratives and illness beliefs, and also culturally sensitive communication. That means we explore how the patient look at the illness, and then we try to communicate with them the Western diagnosis without scaring them away. And also we, at the end, we negotiate treatment with them. How to explore patients' illness beliefs? It is easy. Give them time and sit them and don't talk and let them talk. So this is the way traditionally psychiatrists were being trained. But recently this has been replaced by structured interview, by computerized templates, and these skills has been dropped by a lot of the trainees. So give patient time, let them tell you the story, learn from the patient his, her format, his, her framework, the language they use, the explanation, and also the conception they use. And then use the same language and format and framework to communicate with the patients. And also make sure that it is related to the patient's background and his, her physical concerns as well as social system. Give you an example, like if you say, tell to a patient, oh, you have depression, let me give you some pills. One of my patients would say that, why should I be taking pills? It's my husband who is crazy. So we have to explain to the patient that, I mean, which may be true, but then it is the patient who is suffering with the symptoms. So we have to make sense to the patient so that he or she can understand what we're trying to do and try to avoid unintended terminology with stigma and try to involve patients. And also, other climate proposed to use these 8 questions. If you ask these questions systematically, you have a three-dimensional sense of how the patient conceives his her problems, what the patient is looking for when they come to your office. They have expectations, they have thoughts, they have something they want from your office, and then it is a good idea, particularly those people who are from a different culture, not typically the way you get from your textbook case. So it is fine to accept different explanations and also try to explain what you mean by you have depression. So one way is to tell them that you told me that you have not been able to sleep, you have lost your appetite, lost your interest, and you've been irritable. And in the West, we call this depression, which is fairly similar to what you just told me. You said you have liver fire, right? It is the same thing. So then you are serving as a bridge for the two cultures and make sure patients understand what you want to do for them. And it is important to be flexible with terminology. And like the first time you see a patient, you usually don't say, you have schizophrenia. This is hard to establish a rapport if you do that. Or I think you have delusional disorder. Then the patient won't come back. It is important to tell the patient about his or her diagnosis, but may not be the first visit. So, and then you explain to them what you want to do and describe the possible side effects, and then discuss with the patient possible options that he or she can choose, and then discuss what he would accept. And you, since there are very few of us in this country who are bilingual, bicultural, so it makes sense to have a centralized hub or resources so that the few of us who can serve a lot of populations in the community. So this is why we designed the interview using video conferencing. And also we included a care manager in this aspect because clinicians are busy. We are asking care manager to do hand-holding, monitoring, and supporting patients in between visits. So we did a study and between 2009 and 2012, and then we used PHQ-9 for screening, confirmed their diagnosis with SCID, and then we randomized patients who were eligible, who has depression, into intervention group, who received the culturally sensitive interview plus care management, and control group who did not receive culturally sensitive interview and no care management. And then we use Hamilton Depression Scale for measuring the outcomes, and clinical global impressions for outcome, and also quality of life, enjoyment and satisfaction. And we look at the response rate and remission rate. And we screened more than 24,000 patients in the primary care clinics, and about 4% of them screened positive for depression, and then some of them already received treatment, so they did not join the study. Some of them did not have a real diagnosis of major depressive disorder. And we randomized 190 patients into the two groups. And the outcome showed that the response rate and also the remission rate was much higher in the intervention group, like 45% compared to 17%, and 32% compared to 10%. And the odds ratio were about 4.4. So it worked. So, and also other continuous measures show significant improvement except the social functioning, qualitative QLESQ. So the conclusion is that systematic depression screening is useful for identifying depression among Chinese Americans and actively calling them and say that, do you want to come in? You screen positive, it's important, otherwise they won't come to see you. And it is feasible and acceptable to our patients to use video conferencing to conduct psychiatric interviews. And the collaborative care model we were testing seemed to be working. We need to replicate it and then hopefully to disseminate this. Thank you.
Now I'd like to invite our speakers to sit by me and have a sip of water. And I'd like to open up for our discussion. So for those of you who were unable to ask your burning questions, now is your time. Any questions, comments? Okay. Can you stand up and then perhaps tell us who you are and ask questions? So was that a comment or a question? Question. So younger generations'
yes.
Perceptions and experience with mental health?
Exactly.
Is that okay? Is there any panel member who can address the question?
Mm-hmm. In my clinical experience, I see a lot of younger immigrants and also children of older immigrants. And my experience is that they are somewhere between white and immigrant. So they learn from their parents, and also they inherit some of the ideas that were passed down by their parents. And then, of course, their language capacity is much better, and then they do have certain degree of Western thinking. But on the other hand, you still see a lot of denial or disagreement with the Western way of seeing things about mental illness.
So one of the data that sort of speaks with is also from the NLAT study that shows that prevalence of depression being reported to the structured interview is higher for the second generation compared to the first generation. So adapting the Western ways among the second generation and third generation does seem to lead to better detection based on these results. So there is that probably better utilization.
So in my own research, I think the acculturation, the cultural adaptation research, the environmental justice issue, that And so I've been thinking that a lot recently, but I know there's not much research out there. So in the past, we tend to look at different cultures of patients, and maybe that would influence the parents' perception, like how, yeah. So we know usually like culturalism tends to be more of a Western side. But even a lot of parents that stay in the U.S. for longer than 10 years, they feel like in their own culture, because they're not quite adapted to U.S. culture. And I'm curious, like, I don't have the answer yet, but that's something we're hoping to look into in the future.
Yeah, sometimes I'm just looking at myself as subject of that particular hypothesis testing laboratory. So, you know, there's a period of time that I feel depressed, and I like, maybe I should really have some sort of a therapy. It would be really good. So all my, you know, educational training, research experience, pointing I needed, you know, you should go see someone. It will be really helpful to you. But I, you know, find myself very reluctant to do that. Is it because I have still inherit that, you know, stigmatizations or whatever? I mean, I still, even though I'm making a, you know, paper out of that, pointing out some of those unreasonable, you know, the symptoms that our cultural groups still have, you know, namely one of them is that, you know, this is a sign of weakness and you should be all together. I'm almost writing it as a sort of mitigating that particular myth. But when it comes down to my own practice, I reluctant to do that. So is that because of those things I really hang on to it? And it's that very powerful. The cultural practice are very powerful things who are lasting longer. My children's stage, I've been filling all my family secrets there. So, you know, what my child has, you know, had a period about, you know, a very turbulent youth period. And I recommend him to go to psychotherapy. I said, you know, you might want to just speak to someone other than your mom. You know, I'm happy to listen, but I'm a very biased person. You know, I don't think that I'm a good counselor for you. You go talk to some people, and he had no problem going, you know, to have a counseling. So perhaps there is some generational difference. But I'm just telling you, I'm a mixed 1.5 generation, right? So maybe some families, those things are, you know, taking less, you know, maybe longer time to be, you know, completely free from all those cultural belief system that never has to go out, taking help on maybe their family.
I know you had another question in the back. Okay, what'd you like?
Physicians, they tend to normalize the symptoms. They tend to talk to the older adults that this is, you feel tired, it's normal, for the older adults. And you feel kind of like sleepy, it's normal, you don't have appetite. It's not a big deal. So, I mean, do the same experience, like compare the younger adults. Physicians also have.
So the question is the differences in terms of experiencing these depressive symptoms between younger and older generation, which I think is somewhat similar to what you were asking, right?
Particularly older adults, what they think about the physician's
role. So probably I think we can focus our discussion on provider behavior, attitudes.
You know, those are two psychiatrists in there, so there's authority. But from the patient advocate, you know, the perspective that I, you know, been involved with the community center and working with the patients a lot of times, I definitely see that phenomenon. Not only for the mental health, but even as just preventive care advices or, you know, hypertension, diabetes, people are, somehow the physicians, primary care providers in our own community, who typically trained in, their own country, speak the same languages, so they have a great rapport with the patients. However, they lower their expectations, they lower the treatment, goal. So hypertension, no matter, how the most recent trial is, you really have to treat your hypertension and bring your blood pressure as low as possible. None of those things are really happening there. Oh, 140 over 90 is perfect. 160 over 90? Oh, that's geriatric. Your blood sugar is a little bit higher. Well, that's a geriatric diabetes. And my mom came back and said, my doctor said I had a geriatric diabetes. I want to really curse out. I said, what the heck is that? I just really, it's same thing with the non. Oh, yeah. And sometimes they just prescribe the medication directly and not telling them the symptoms for their mental depression. Mm. And I'm going to have Dr. Neal or
So I think there are different ways to look at it. One way to look at it is that if patients have persistent symptoms and then you can normalize it, but then the question is, do you have better treatment for that? Do you have approaches that help the patient? So yes, it is normal, it is fatigue and so on. It is not abnormal. But say if you give them some medications, you give them therapy, that may help them. So that'll be great. And also another way is that if you do systematic screening, then it is black and white. You know that you have certain symptoms, and then you deserve treatment. On the other hand, you can also argue that, can we do it? This is alternative treatment, other ways to treat. If you look at the data, if you use acupuncture, if you use mindfulness training, Tai Chi or Qigong, patients do improve. So it is not just Western treatment only. So people are in distress, we give them a label, and then we can use different ways to manage this, to manage this distress and help patients do that.
When you are working within this area of minority mental health area, we are essentially thinking about maybe how do you deliver mental health service to geographically dispersed groups that's all over, that is linguistically adequate. It's basically privilege. And Dr. Young's work is related to having telemedicine tools to deliver these in a far geographic area. Myung's work is related to developing community mental health workers with potential skin features and perhaps also delivery. There are also, you cannot avoid but to be creative because we have a limited workforce to do this, and we have a very widely distributed minority workforce. So that's a responsibility and a burden of being a minority mental health.
Okay, for the interest of time, I think we have to close this session. However, please feel free to come over here and then ask further questions. Also, before I let you go, I just wanted to tell you that there are copies of a special issue that was put forth by the APF, who published their work on Asian American health issues. They also provided quite a bit of in-depth literature review that was published in the Journal of Healthcare for the Poor and Underserved, which is right outside. So on your way out, feel free.